This is the new Weight Watchers. It works for members like JoJo, who's learning simple, healthy habits, Sharia, who's making progress with meds, and Kim, who still gets to eat what she loves. For over 60 years, we've helped millions of members find what works for them. Now, it's your turn. Watch your life open up. Watch your story shift. Watch what you're capable of. Watch it work. Get started today at WeightWatchers.com.
Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland.
On News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof on News Talk. I'm Jonathan McRae. So lots of animals behave differently during the winter. Hedgehogs hibernate, birds migrate. Of course, hamsters sleep through the winter like many other animals. But how do they know when to start? On this week's Future Proof, a genetic switch has been found that flips in all living animals and plants. Hear all about it in a few minutes' time. If you'd like to get in touch with the program, you can email us, science@newstalk.com, or you can find us on Twitter. We're at @newstalkscience. First up, it's time to look back at some of the more interesting stories from the world of science this week. We're joined by Dr. Fergus McAuliffe from Trinity College Dublin and Dr. Ruth Freeman from Research Ireland. Our first story, Ruth, has to do with childhood development.
It has to do with childhood development and climate change and, I suppose, heat. And over, you know, here in Europe, we've heard about every year we say this is the hottest year on record. And we know part of that is heat waves during the summer. And we'll frequently hear about news reports which talks about vulnerable people, higher rates of death, just because of being able to cope with that extreme heat. And we know that we all know, we don't even need science to tell us, a lot extreme heat affects how well we can perform and maybe even how well we can think. But early childhood development hadn't been well studied in this whole area. And we know that kind of children aged 3, 4, when you're learning to read, when you're hitting those early milestones, it's a really critical part time for brain development. So this is new research that was published in the Journal of Child Psychology and Psychiatry. From researchers in the US, and they analysed data from nearly 20,000 children aged 3 to 4 across 6 countries. So they looked at Gambia, Georgia, Madagascar, Malawi, Palestine and Sierra Leone. And what they did is they combined the early childhood development records with climate data and household surveys. And what they found was that children who were exposed to average maximum temperatures above 30 degrees Celsius were 5 to 7% less likely to reach those basic literacy and numeracy milestones compared to those who were in average temperatures below 30 degrees. And again, not surprisingly and sadly, the impacts were strongest for children in, you know, more disadvantaged homes. So if you had a lower income, less access to clean water, higher urban density, probably less access to cooling technology as well, that impact was greater. So I don't think this will surprise many people, this research. I think we intuitively know it, but it certainly is highlighting.
But in terms of controlling for all of those other things that you're talking about, I mean, is it necessarily the temperature? I mean, you know, in Dubai, for example, where everything is air conditioned, you might have those temperatures, but you can easily manage. I mean, is the temperature, because when I read the story first, I was wondering, is there something happening with the, you know, the child's physiology that's actually preventing them from reaching those cognitive milestones. But maybe it's actually just circumstances and environment rather than the actual temperature.
I mean, I think the fact that they could, there was a range of countries here, and because it's such a big study and because they had household surveys as well, I think they did try to control for some of those effects. So we do see this effect in all children, you know, whether they're in a sort of advantaged or disadvantaged household. It was stronger in those from disadvantaged households.
Right.
But again, I don't think it's that surprising. And, you know, while we don't think about having to deal with this kind of issue here in Ireland, I mean, we have had some pretty hot days in our summers over the last few years. And I know certainly there are workplaces and schools across Ireland that are not geared up to deal with high temperatures. And, you know, often you do walk into a room and the temperature's got pretty uncomfortable. So we know now that this is probably impacting on children's ability to hit those first milestones in education. So, look, it's just another flag going up to say this is something we need to think about.
And just actually the variability of heat that people are willing to tolerate. I'm very sensitive to heat. And I can't function in a room that's very, very warm. I can function in a room that's very cold, but a room that's very, very warm, my brain does not work. So it's, I know it's not the same, but it's adjacent, it rhymes. Fergus, our second story is a little bit more lighthearted. It's to do with pheasants.
Yes, so it's performative males in the animal kingdom again. So what this particular study was looking at was pheasants that have large ornamentation around their heads for males, and how that ornamentation is so big and so large and so extravagant that it actually prevents the males from seeing properly. So what this particular team in Oxford University did was that they measured the field of view of two pheasant species, the golden and the lady Amherst's, and they compared the male's field of vision versus the female's field of vision. And it's only the males that have this large amount of feather ornamentation kind of around the top and the sides of their heads. Now, how they did that is they used an ophthalmoscope. Now, people will actually be very familiar with this. So when you go to the doctor and, you know, the way she shines the light into your eye, that's an ophthalmoscope. And what they were looking for when they did that, so they kind of quite gently held the pheasants in place and they moved the ophthalmoscope around. And what they were looking for is flashback. So when you're driving at night on the road, say, and you see an animal up in the distance and all you can see is their two eyes, that's flashback. And they move the torch around, and depending on the angle of movement of the torch, they could figure out when the bird could see or no longer see the light. And that gave an idea of the field of view. And what they found was that comparing the males and the females, that the males had 30 or 40 degrees less field of vision than the females, which is quite an amount of your vision to actually lose, especially because these birds are often predated. So this particular study, which compares males versus females, is actually the first of its kind in animals. And one particular idea as to why this happens is they think that these particular pheasant species, they live in quite dense forests. So maybe they can't see that much anyway, and it's not as much of a loss.
Right.
But there's also an argument there is that this is an example of a somewhat controversial principle. And this says that if you're able to put energy and resources into extravagant displays like the huge plumes of peacock feathers or peacock's tail, then you must be doing so well that you can afford to do that.
Huh.
So animals with lower displays or less amounts of feathers are doing less well, hence they can't do that. And bizarrely, this particular theory has been extended out of the animal kingdom and into our human society. And it's linked to this idea of, say if you take the example of like a luxury car, weirdly, the higher the price of the luxury car, the greater the demand for that car amongst a certain section of society. Because if you're able to afford that, it means that you have the resources to afford it and you want to display that. So performative males, animal kingdom and human society alike.
I want you to take a moment now to just stop what you're doing and Google a photograph of the golden pheasant. Now, as it is with most birds, the female isn't as beautiful as the male, although in this case, it's actually quite a gorgeous looking bird. But the golden pheasant is the most extraordinary bird I've ever seen. I haven't seen a bird that looks like this ever. So it has sort of a Donald Trump sort of hairstyle on the top, and then this weird sort of a bolero of orange and black stripes. And that sits on top this sort of cascading sort of Art Deco blue that finishes with sort of what looks like yellow fur. And it's got this really striking red scarlet breast. It's actually an incredible looking bird. And when it hides itself or displays for the female, it sort of covers up its entire face with this orange and black plumage. It's incredible looking. So I'll give you a moment to do that.
Yeah, we don't have, I don't think we have anything like this in Ireland that compares to it at all.
No, it's stunning. I never heard of the golden pheasant. All right, let's move on. Ruth, our third story has to do with fire.
Making fire, yeah, that sort of primeval human thing that we always think about when we think about Stone Age people. And obviously fire was a really, really important milestone in human evolution because it enabled us to stay warm in colder places, cooking. You know, we were able to use it to protect ourselves maybe from some things that might come and get us. And until now, it was thought that the oldest widely accepted evidence for controlled man-made fire in Europe dated back to about 50,000 years ago in northern France. Now, there are sites in Europe and in other places. I know you love dating and archaeology, Jonathan, your favourite topic. Jonathan is looking sceptical. So there are traces of fires in other places. But the question is, archaeologists have questioned whether those were naturally occurring fires where maybe people took a branch from a fire where there had been a lightning strike, or were people able to kind of reproduce fire reliably so it became sort of a technology. And this research comes from the UK. It's from a place in Suffolk, and researchers were looking at a site that was dated to 400,000 years ago when there would have been Neanderthals living in Britain. And they found a distinct burn patch with very tight boundaries. And they showed that this area was associated with stone tools. So it was in an area where there was people living, early people living. And what they found also was pieces of iron pyrite. So these are essentially the things, the flint, beside flint tools, they would have used that to start the fire. They could also see that the clay had been heated to nearly 1,000 degrees. And that's a temperature that's only consistent with kind of sustained, controlled fire. So this was published in Nature just this week. And it was published, I think, because it is seen as such a radical departure from what was the accepted wisdom, that rather than fire being a controlled technology that humans had in Europe 50,000 years ago, this suggests it was 400,000 years ago. So it's quite a big leap backwards in this study.
It really is. And as you say, Ruth, this is one of my bugbears when it comes to paleoanthropology, archaeology, and the study of things that happened a long time ago. I feel like often we get information that is so, you know, it's written into the history books as this is what happened. And I feel like it's actually doing a massive disservice to our understanding of what happened, you know, before history, because we just don't have enough information to say fires were started 50,000 years ago. If all of a sudden someone can write a paper and say, well, actually, no, it was actually 400,000 years ago. I mean, that is such a radical update to our knowledge. And this is obviously well researched, because Nature papers don't tend to be published without good evidence. I just feel like on this program over the years, we've heard such complete and utter reshaping of, you know, cornerstone things like when Africans came out of Africa and moved to populate the rest of the world, you know, how people got to America, as you say now, you know, these tools. Well, you know, different species have popped into existence and disappeared from existence because someone's found a bit of a tooth. It's kind of crazy that we're now suggesting 400,000 years ago. But presumably it's difficult to find these sort of sites, right? If this is the first kind of site that gives this suggestion, it's probably the first of its kind that old that has something like this.
Yeah, and look, you can see here, so this was part of a long-running excavation. There's a project called Pathways to Ancient Britain that's going on. And I guess to have the funding to go out and really look in detail at these sites for probably years and years and years, because archaeologists are going through layers and layers of clay and information that's all been compacted down on top of itself. But you can see here, you know, I think you're right. In the past, often it was sort of one data point or two. Here, the researchers have put together a lot of different data points. So they've looked the tools, for example, the flint tools that they found were shattered. So obviously when these ancient humans were knocking the flint against the pyrite, sometimes they broke the flint. You know, you can see that here we're getting more demanding of the evidence that we're asking for. And look, I think we're also having a bit more humility. You're right. Like there was a new ancient skull found in China earlier this year, which again, rewrote the story of human evolution. But I think now we're saying, look, we're still putting the pieces together. But isn't that fascinating?
Yeah, yeah, that would be great. A little bit more. What happened in the past? We really are not quite sure. Just give us another 1,000 years. All right. Our final story, Fergus, has to do with spiders.
Yes. So something else maybe for our listeners to Google would be the amazing webs of bark spiders. So these are native to Madagascar, and the size of the webs that they can craft are enormous, like up to 25 meters in size. They can stretch across rivers. There's a few photos online of people like standing next to these webs, and they're just absolutely dwarfed. So what this particular study was aiming to look at was, is there a difference in the quality and the strength of the webs that are made by male and female bark spiders? So what the researchers did from Slovenia was they collected egg sacs from bark spiders, and they brought them back to the lab, and then they essentially grew the spiders. And they were looking at a couple of different things. Is there a difference between male and female spiders? But B, is there a difference between juvenile spiders, which are called spiderlings, which I didn't know, but makes them actually seem much more cute.
Spiderlings.
I never knew this. Yeah, just it's completely reshaped my relationship with spiders, if I'm honest. So they compared, spiderlings to mature spiders' webs. How they did that was they measured their width using little microscopes, but also they stress tested them, so essentially pushing and pulling them until they snapped. And what they found really was that it's only the adult female bark spiders that produce this truly exceptional silk that, that pound for pound is stronger than steel and tougher than Kevlar. All male spiders...
It's the toughest biological material in the world, as far as we know, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so there's actually been a lot of studies that that looked into like how strong, how tough it is, its tensile strength, all these things, and it is really, really a remarkable biological material. And what they found in the study then is when they compared these exceptional webs of the mature females to males, is that so male spiders and juvenile spiders, the quality of the silk that they produce is of a lower quality, so they cannot produce these truly exceptional webs. And the reason for that then is what is known as ontogenic plasticity. Now, what that means is that as a species goes through its different life stages, things change. So male species and juvenile species, which are smaller. So the key thing here is a mature female bark spider is 10 to 100 times the size of a male.
Wow.
So males, basically, they don't need to produce these huge webs because they actually can't do anything with the prey that they would catch. So they focus on having these weaker webs that are smaller and that they can catch smaller prey that they can deal with. Whereas the much bigger mature females are able to catch the likes of dragonflies, and as a result of that, they have a web that can do so.
Wow. Again, an incredible looking animal, and the idea that the female is up to 100 times bigger is both freaky and fascinating. Dr. Fergus McAuliffe and Dr. Ruth Freeman, thanks so much. Now, every winter, we see the same natural rhythms play out. Birds migrate, mammals hunker down, some creatures even slip into months-long hibernation. But how do they know when it's winter? A team of researchers may have finally cracked the code. Well, Professor Tyler Stevenson, Head of Physiology, Aging and Welfare at the University of Glasgow, joins me now. Welcome to the programme, Tyler. It's lovely to have you on. I suppose this is one of those questions that you think has an obvious answer, but actually it doesn't.
And you're exactly right. We've known for a very long time, just observing animals in the wild, that they show these remarkable changes across the year. And you've highlighted migration as one. The Canada geese have started to come through Glasgow right now, and we have these massive flocks, and they know that they need to go to southern climes to survive the winters. And then they know at a certain time of the year they need to fly back in order to reproduce. And we've observed these events in birds and mammals for millennia. And we've never really known how they actually time these events. We know how they orient their behavior. So they know, we know how they use the sun and different star cues to orient where they need to go. But timing when to come and when to go has always been an elusive issue for us. Using modern techniques, we've finally been able to identify the specific genes that underlie these timing events.
Okay, before we go into the genes, I just wanted to get some examples. So first off, what sort of behavior, because we're talking about the entire animal kingdom, right? There are lots and lots of animals change their behavior as winter comes. What sort of behavior are we talking about apart from the obvious migrating south birds?
So the other one is hibernation that we see a lot in mammals. Insects will go through a period of diapause in which they will have larvae that sit inside the soil. They will reside there for about 6 months, and then they will emerge in the spring, and we have those massive increases in insects during the spring period. So we have these same phenomena across the animal kingdom, including insects and fish, reptiles, birds, and mammals. But we also see it in plants. So the annual leaf changes that we see is also due to these internal timers, our clocks, and there is a genetic component to those annual changes.
Is it not just a matter of temperature? Is temperature alone not the thing that triggers these animals to switch mode to winter mode?
That's a great environmental cue to use. And a lot of times we think that animals are just responding to a warmer climate versus a colder climate. And what we're experiencing right now is a good example to show that even though the temperatures right now are unseasonably warm, we have 11 degrees, 14 degrees in Glasgow today, animals aren't responding to that cue. They will show a modest response at a physiological level. But we do have these long-term annual programs that essentially lock an animal into a particular state. And the response to temperature is going to be greater at one time of the year versus another just due to these annual clocks.
Right. So it's not just temperature alone. And that would make sense because sometimes you have a freak day where, you know, it might be very cold in summer or vice versa due to whatever is going on in the world. And that doesn't mean that instantly all the flowers die or all the birds disappear. So we know it's not just light. Are there other environmental cues that is it like a mixture of all these cues that they take to I want to say decide, but they don't decide, right? They are compelled to do.
Right. The annual change in day length is the primary predictive cue that plants, right, insects, and animals use to time their annual changes in physiology and behavior. So the decrease in day length is what is one cue that a lot of animals use to know that winter is coming. And then the annual increase after the winter solstice is used to anticipate reproduction in order to breed at a time where there's an increase in nutrients available for their offspring.
Right. Okay. That makes obvious sense now that I think about it.
The annual change in day length is the initial predictive cue that animals use to anticipate month or time of the year. And then temperature and these other environmental cues are used to modify the responses at that particular time of year.
Well, what about, I mean, it's going to sound really stupid, but I love asking stupid questions. Aren't most of the animals who are, say, for example, hibernating, don't they have their eyes closed? Aren't a lot of them underground? How do they know that it's daylight above ground?
That's a brilliant question that I would say. What is happening there is that as the day lengths are getting shorter from the summer to the autumn, that initiates a genetic response. And what our research was showing is that around the equinox or shortly after the equinox in the autumnal direction, you see a gene that is essentially turned on in the brain. And that is the initial timer that sets a 6 month long event in which the animals will go into this dormancy state. They will hibernate, they'll go through torpor. And then after about 4 or 5 months, they start to emerge out of this torpor state. And that's when you can have temperature having a slight effect in which they can speed up the clock or slow it down.
Right. Okay. So what you're saying is that if these, this genetic change happens, if it gets really warm, those animals are just going to wake up much quicker.
Yeah. So the genetic change that happened already has set in place a series of events that is going to tick along throughout the months of winter, and then they will start to emerge, and temperature then can reduce the time, so they can come out of hibernation earlier, or if it's colder, they'll stay in hibernated state longer. So even though they're underground, they don't need to see the daily cues that we're getting from, say, December, January, and February.
Okay, so it's basically an alarm clock. The genetic change, is this an epigenetic change? It happens on top of the genome?
Great question. There's both levels. So we do have a genetic change in which the gene has to be transcribed and produced into a protein. And part of that is being regulated by an epigenetic mark known as DNA methylation.
Okay, yeah. So that means that there's activity happening on a gene, but the gene itself isn't necessarily changing. Although we do see these different proteins being made, and that basically once that happens, be triggered by the shortening of the day, because they're out in this period, the day shortens, that triggers the alarm clock, and that starts the wind down, and times for 6 months later the wind back up. That's genetically encoded in their DNA?
Yes.
How do we know that?
Well, we know that because no matter what species we look at, whether it's going to be a mammal or a bird, and within mammals and birds, they all show this response. So if we take sheep will also show this response at this time of the year, where the gene DIO3 is turned on in November, and then it's rapidly turned off, and that sets a long-term timer, much the same. But in this case, sheep, as we all know, they're not hibernators. They don't go through torpor. But what they do have is a lambing phase in which reproduction is timed so that the lambs are born at a time of the year where they will initially have to get their nutrients from their mother, and then they'll be able to feed off the grass in the springtime.
Okay. Say I put an animal, and I don't want to do this. Let's call it a hypothetical. Say I put an animal in a box, yeah, and that box is dark all the time. But they get fed, same food, same drink, 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. What happens to that animal?
So let's take your ground squirrel and stick it in that box, and we'll make the temperature 4 degrees, food, water, constantly. These experiments have been done back in the 60s and 70s. And what we know with those ground squirrels is that they will cycle through an annual change in body mass. So they increase during the summer, and then they decrease their body mass during the winter. That happens in the box, even though the light cues aren't changing. And this is referred to as an endogenous intrinsic rhythm.
Wow.
And they will do that for up to about 4 years.
And then after that, this wears off, and they become very upset, I would imagine, very disoriented.
Well, it's much like a daily clock, where if we took an animal and stuck it into an environment where the light was constant darkness. So they do this with a lot of mice studies, where they'll have all the environmental cues, but they'll be in constant darkness, and they'll have an approximately 24-hour rhythm that slowly wanes, and then it becomes what we refer to as an
25 hours. Is that right?
Well, it essentially dampens out and becomes arrhythmic.
Right. Okay.
If we did this with an animal, you would have the same annual rhythm, approximate 365 days. But then after, let's say, 10 years in our hypothetical experiment, that rhythm would start to dissipate and they'd become seasonally arrhythmic.
Okay, so this gene then, is this in any way related to the circadian rhythm? Or are they two separate clocks?
Two separate clocks. So the circadian clock has 15 to 20 genes, approximately. The circannual clock, this endogenous genetic program, what we know is that there are approximately 25 genes that are associated with it, but they're functional. Whether they actually play a role or not hasn't been identified. And our study was the first to show this one, in particular, referred to as DIO3, is involved in the circannual clock.
So what about... I want to pitch a theory to you before we finish, because I've had this theory for quite some time, and I think you would be a perfect person to answer it. But before we do that, what about humans? How come we don't show the same rhythm? Or is there something going on under the surface that we're not fully aware of when it comes to shorter days or longer nights?
So we do respond to the seasonal changes in day length, and we do have a number of different, what are referred to as seasonal patterns. Some of those seasonal patterns are us just responding to the environment. When it's cold, we put on a jacket. When it's hot, we take off some layers. But there is this genetic program that resides in our cells and in our physiological responses. But the magnitude of the change doesn't really impact our day-to-day lives, because we have all these other different systems in place that allow us to maintain consistency across days. What is interesting, though, is that the gene that we identified is the same across all animals. It's in the exact same cells, and they do the exact same annual change in expression. The difference that we see is the connection between when that gene is turned on and what happens after. And in humans, that what happens after has been disconnected. So in the animals that we studied, when this gene comes on, there's a number of different cells that change their structure. And the changing of the structure changes the downstream effects on physiology. That changing of the structure doesn't happen in humans.
Right. And some of those changes are quite large, right? The changes in structure, what they look like the tree frog, for example, can turn into a literal ice cube. No heartbeat, no movement whatsoever. It looks like literally an inanimate object if it goes cold enough. There are lots of things that these animals do that are wildly different in terms of physiological change, but significant change.
Exactly. And in nature, there are some extreme changes that are absolutely remarkable and really exciting to study. But animals that are able to drop down their temperature, body temperature, so low that they're resting roughly around the freezing level. So the ground squirrels we talked about before, when they go into hibernation, their body temperature drops down to about 4 degrees.
Tyler Stevenson, thank you so much for joining us. Tyler is from the University of Glasgow. He is head of physiology, aging and welfare there. Tyler, thanks for your time.
Thank you very much.
Before we wrap up, just some of your comments from last week's episode. We spoke to Lena Zagaga from Trinity College Dublin about vitamin D. She was talking about its link to BMI, but all sorts of conditions that you probably wouldn't have realized. She says, so does that mean that some people are genetically more likely to be low in vitamin D no matter how much sun they get? I work indoors a lot, so definitely don't get enough. Because you've got to, you know, you've got to trade off, as Lena was saying, your exposure to sunlight, which can cause cancer, and your intake of vitamin D. So yes, you're absolutely right. And working indoors, particularly if you're working shifts, that can run absolute havoc on your health. So do look after yourself. Emma Whelan from Maynooth University was talking to us about the way she is looking at young stars forming and their young planets. Someone says, I was intrigued to hear your guest mention the small subscription access satellite model. Is that common for accessing satellite data? Well, Emma explained that those larger telescopes, you have to sort of prove your worth scientifically, and then you're allocated time on that particular telescope. But yeah, some of the smaller satellites allow that. I think it's a fairly rare model. I haven't heard of it before. But I must follow with Emma. Thanks very much for your text. That's it from us on this week's episode. Thanks to Marisa O'Sullivan, Rory Galvin, Hugo da Silva, Scott on sound. We'll be back with more Future Proof in your podcast feed on Tuesday. In the meantime, stay curious.
Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland.
Sundays from midday on News Talk.
Weight Watchers now offers access to affordable GLP-1s.
Weight Watchers has everything I need, from weight loss medications to nutrition support and help with my side effects.
With our program, our members are losing more weight with expert nutrition and side effect support.
Weight Watchers prescribing GLP-1 medications, it's been life-changing.
Better results, expert support, lose more weight, make it last. Get started today for as low as $25 at weightwatchers.com.